She won't ask for it.
Welcome to this event. We are here partly to listen to what everybody else says and partly to welcome the distinguished Sanjay Lal visiting fellow. He should have been the distinguished Sanjay Lal visiting professor, but the university suddenly, the day before the appointments committee, realised, oh my God, he's too old. He's not allowed to be here under the Employer Justified Retirement Act or something like this. And so suddenly he ceased to be a visiting professor, but became visible. He is a visiting professor, really. And since then, they've relaxed their rules. So you just hit the wrong moment. If you'd been about 2 months earlier or 2 months later, you'd been a visiting professor. But as it is, you're a visiting fellow. Now, I'm here as an imposter. I'm an epidemiologist and not an economist. And actually, I'm here because I was a friend of Sanjay's. And at that time, it was Green College rather than Green Templeton College. And Richard Doll introduced me to Sanjay and said to me very quietly, you should talk to him and you should listen to what he says. And so, you know, I started off talking and talking, not listening to what he said. But later on, I found that Richard was right and that the best thing to do was to listen to what Sanjay said. He just had an extraordinary wealth of knowledge, which, you know, I wished I'd had, but I didn't. And he'd got such a range of experience of a lot of countries that weren't necessarily the most newsworthy countries. And he tried to explain to me about, you know, how firms developed, how actually the governments of the countries that had succeeded had really taken a very active role. It was none of this passive capitalism they're told is good for everybody. They've actually taken a very active role in making these countries develop, and tried to explain to me some things about this, which some of which I understood and some of which I'm sure I didn't. But he was just delightful. He was lovely company. He was very modest. And whenever I did interrupt and start talking about my stuff, then he'd let me as well, which was nice of him. And through him, I met Rani, who then entertained everybody to dinner. And it was a delightful arrangement. And I didn't really find out, I shouldn't say this, but I didn't really find out until after he was dead just how distinguished he was. I just thought he was an extraordinarily interesting person to talk to. But then, you know, everybody started talking about what he'd achieved, and it all turned out to be true. So it has been a great pleasure over the last 10 years to listen to, or the last several years, to listen to the presentations by the various Sanjay Lal visiting professors. And I hope that today will be no exception. As you know, Sanjay was very interested in firms in developing countries and how they really worked, how things actually worked, not how they were supposed to work, but how they actually worked. We're here, I'm speaking as one of the trustees of the Sanjay Lal Memorial Fund, which Rani set up to endow these visiting professorships. And on behalf of the trustees, I bid you all welcome here. And I hope that this evening is as interesting as previous evenings have been. Thank you very much indeed.
It's a great honour and pleasure to be chairing tonight's event commemorating the life and work of Sanjay Lal. I would like to start by thanking the trustees of Sanjay Lal Trust. I would like to start by thanking Green Templeton College and Mrs. Rani Lal for continuing this very successful initiative and for bringing us all here together. Before I introduce our panelists, I would like to say a few words about Sanjay's work. I haven't had the privilege of meeting him in person, but I feel that I got to know a part of him by reading his writings. I've read his work while I was a student. I've read his work while I was an economist working in international development. And I always found his writings very refreshing. They were refreshing because he talked about real world issues. He talked about how countries were affected by globalization, while university lectures focused on country A and B trading infinite number of goods. His work was refreshing because he dared to challenge conventional wisdom, and he did this during the heydays of Washington Consensus and structural adjustment lending. His work was broad, deep, intensely focused. In all the books, articles, reports he published during his 30 years at Oxford, he always sought to understand why countries are doing better than others. and his ultimate goal being trying to find ways of improving the lives of those who have less. He looked at the challenge of economic development through the lens of multinational corporations, technology transfer, and globalization. And he kept an open mind while doing this, documenting both the good sides and the bad sides of FDI. He talked about the good impact of multinationals through linkages, through technology transfer. But he also wasn't shy to point out that FDI has a dark side. It may crowd out local firms. It may be associated with transfer pricing. He was also ahead of the curve at the time where most academics tried to wrap their heads around the impact of FDI inflows into developing countries. He was already thinking about FDI originating from developing countries. And therefore, it's very fitting that the subject of today's evening is emerging market multinationals in the 21st century. We are very fortunate to have three very distinguished panelists, Professor Avinash Dixit from Princeton, Professor Tim Besley from the London School of Economics, and Professor Robert Wade, also from the London School of Economics. And it's quite nice that Avinash is the current holder of the post, while Robert was the first holder of Sanjaya Lal Distinguished Fellowship. The plan for the evening is as follows. Avinash will speak for about 30 to 40 minutes. Then our other two panelists will have the floor for about 15 to 20 minutes each. And that should leave us 20 minutes for questions. We aim to finish before 7 o'clock. And at 7 o'clock, we'll move outside for a short reception that will conclude the evening. I will introduce Tim and Robert as we come to their remarks, but now let me say a few words about Avinash. He clearly needs no introduction, but let me just remind you about a few facts from his very impressive CV. He is John Sherratt University Professor of Economics Emeritus at Princeton. He is also a distinguished adjunct professor at Lingnan University in Hong Kong and a senior research fellow at Nuffield. He has a very wide range of interests spanning microeconomic theory, game theory, international trade, growth, public economics, and even the new institutional economics. He has thought about questions as diverse as how should firms decide whether and when to invest, to what can we learn from movies about game theory. His many honors include presidency of the Econometric Society and the American Economic Association, membership in the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the National Academy of Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society. He is also a corresponding fellow of the British Academy. Avinash, the floor is yours. We are looking forward to your talk.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Beata, for these very nice introductions. I should say that I'm perfectly happy not to be a professor, but just a jolly good fellow. In fact, what Richard said reminded me of John Maynard Keynes, who was never a professor at Cambridge. And the person who was professor, there was only one professor, although a very distinguished economist in his own right, well, people of Keynes' generation had something of contempt for him. So whenever Americans addressed Keynes as Professor Keynes, he said that what he really disliked about being called professor was suffering the indignity without getting the salary. It's always a pleasure for me to come back to Oxford, where I have so many old friends, and every time I come, I make several new friends. But this time, it's a particular honor and privilege to come here as the Sanjaya Lal Visiting Fellow. I actually knew Sanjay and interacted with him when I was in Oxford in the early 70s. And like everybody else, was impressed by his not just intellect, but real concern for developing countries, and at that time he was kind of just beginning on what I think is his most original, far-seeing and pioneering work on foreign direct investment coming out of emerging markets. Therefore, I'm particularly lucky to have been able to think of a topic that follows that up. What's happened in the last 20 or 30 years in the field of foreign direct investment out of emerging markets? Actually, on that particular subject, and in fact on international economics more generally, I think I can say without fear of downplaying any of their contributions on my right, that Beata is the real expert. And in a way, she should have been the main speaker, and maybe I should have chaired this session. So with luck, she will have a little bit of time at the end to give us her own thoughts. So for those of you who are completely new to the subject, very, very quick statement of how big a thing foreign direct investment is. And here's the world volume of foreign or value of foreign direct investment. Of course, at this point for the whole world, it should be equal whether it's out or in. In practice, it isn't for various reasons. There are kind of errors. But I've taken the out figures and five-year averages for a reason that I'll mention. And you'll see that this is a big thing. In the last 5 years, it's been close to $1.5 trillion a year and has grown very substantially over 20 years. So it's really a big problem that we are talking about. And to understand it properly, we need to ask why this particular method of international transactions, if you like, gets chosen. For example, why not make the stuff at home and export to different countries when you might be able to realize more economies of scale in producing at home? Or why not license production to people in the other country where you want to sell, because they know the local market better, they might be able to tailor the product to that market in a better way, and on the whole, it'll be more profitable to do so. So why choose investing in the other country and producing there yourself? The traditional theory of investment across countries arose roughly in the following way. They thought of multinational enterprises as firms that were located in advanced countries, which I'll call North in the traditional way. They have advantages in that they have better technologies, they're advanced in R&D, and they have management skills. After all, they're graduates, MBAs from Harvard and whatnot, and they could try and sell these things separately. You could just sell management services to a firm in the other country, or you could license R&D. But the problem is, what price do you charge for it? And for reasons of information asymmetry, that's often rather difficult to write contracts on. So you license things to someone else to produce in another country. They might produce more than the contract specifies and sell it on the side. It'll be very difficult for you to prove that they've been cheating you in that kind of way. The southern country, which often called the host country where the investment goes, that's the traditional idea, has cheaper labor, advantage in low-tech production, and there might also be problems of writing contracts on this. By the way, again, I should kind of clarify that here, North and South are not geographical labels. They're kind of labels of economic development. So South Korea is in the North, and North Korea is very much in the South. Actually, you shouldn't laugh. I mean, you live in Oxford, and South Parade is way to the north of North Parade. So what foreign direct investment can do is to reduce these costs of contracting. You keep the thing in your own firm, and in your own firm, you are able to arrange things without need to try and enforce contracts in outside courts. You internalize the transaction. So it's the combination of ownership of those specific things like technology, management skills, etc., location where it's advantageous to produce at lower cost, and internalization that is achieved by doing it as a part of your own firm that explains why foreign direct investment can be a preferred mode of international selling in certain circumstances. For those of you who kind of know, this is basically a Williamson-type transaction cost framework, but this was developed independently, actually, by John Dunning and Richard Caves in the context of direct investment, and it's now a kind of pretty much accepted framework. All of that, though, as in fact I mentioned earlier and Beat also said, was originally thought of in terms of northern firms investing in maybe other northern countries, but also southern countries. And things have changed over the last 40 years to the point that multinationals from southern home countries investing in other southern countries, but also in northern countries, have become quite significant. And Sanjay Lal, whom we are honoring today, and Lewis Wells from Harvard Business School were one of the early spotters of this phenomenon emerging. And they published in the same year, 1983, pioneering books studying this phenomenon. Of course, since then, at least at the anecdotal level, it's grown to a point that everybody knows. Here are just a few examples. Lenovo from China bought the PC division of IBM. Mittal and Tata have invested in the UK in steel, and that's gotten to a point where they're starting to disinvest. Tata invested in UK in auto production, Geely in Sweden, the whole lot of Chinese investments in Africa, in resources and land. Anecdotes certainly are big, but we need the plural of anecdotes, namely data, to really see if the phenomenon is merely newspaper stories or something really significant. And so I'll offer a very quick overview of what's been happening, discuss the explanations that were originally offered by Lal and Wells, see how they have stood up, whether new explanations are needed, and things of that kind. Let me begin with just a few of the key findings that were in the 1983 books by Lal and Wells. They found that multinationals from the southern home countries were generally somewhat smaller than those from the northern countries. They had technologies and management methods that were somehow better adapted to conditions in other southern countries, how to deal with, how to manage low-cost, low-skilled labor. They were skilled and better adapted to do that than northern firms, which came with knowledge and management skills of the technologies in their own countries, which might not be very appropriate for the lower wage, lower skill labor that they hired in the southern countries. they're more likely to engage in joint ventures with firms in the host country. They're more likely to engage in bribery of officials in the host country. Nowadays, actually, northern firms are more and more restricted by laws in their own country as to whether and how they can bribe officials in host countries. Of course, with loopholes, you can hire facilitators and all kinds of things. But the northern ones are partly more restricted. But also, the southern ones are more skilled. I mean, bribery is somewhat of a skill. You don't just kind of walk up to an official and ask, how much do you want? You have to cultivate something of a relationship, all that kind of thing. And they have some skills in doing that. I'll say a little bit more about that as we go along. Also, originally, the multinationals from the south were in just a few sectors of the economy, particularly resources, and that's been gradually broadening. That was even true in the mid-1980s, and that has been happening since. So, just to recap again, I'm going to review some of the developments since 1990. I'm going to review explanations for the phenomena, those that were offered previously, and a few new ones. I'll review some recent empirical work and basically ask, is foreign direct investment from the South now basically just like any other foreign direct investment? Or does it still retain or in different way modify some of its special features that were noticeable in the 1980s? I have to begin with a little bit of at least a brief acknowledgement of the problems of data in this, though, because that really is a problem. What actually is direct investment as opposed to buying shares in a foreign firm? And the idea is that direct investment should be something that gives you some measure of control over that firm's operation and management. But how do you define this? How do you distinguish this? And in data, the usual thing is to just have a cutoff. Very often, it's if you own more than 10% of a firm, you have some measure of control. So why 10%? Why not 50? Well, 50 may be asking for too much, but why not 20 or 25? No real answer. That's basically the way it is. What's the home country of a multinational firm? And it's usually where it's listed on a securities exchange or what have you. So a South African firm listed in London, if it invests in, let's say, India, the foreign direct investment will appear to be coming out of England and not South Africa. Foreign investment might go through a third country or might go outside and come back for all kinds of foreign exchange, loopholes, tax reasons, etc., etc. And countries like Hong Kong are particularly significant in this. You see a lot of foreign investment coming out of Hong Kong, going to other countries and going to China. And is it a part of this kind of round-tripping Chinese profits located in Hong Kong being brought back to invest in China or going through Hong Kong for some other reasons? That's a problem. Then whether the investment takes place by a merger or acquisition of an already existing foreign firm, or is it setting up a new plant, greenfield investment as it's often called. And there are attempts to separate the data on this, but they're all problematic. Greenfield in particular, very often you see data on plans and not on actual achievements. Having said this, I'm going to kind of leave this in the background and look at data. You should be aware, therefore, that you need to take those data with a little bit of salt. There's a lot of error in this. And also, there's a whole lot of year-to-year volatility for various reasons. Cyclical reasons, just a big investment, you do it in 1 year, and then it suddenly may fall off, etc. So I usually, wherever possible, like to work in terms of 5-year averages. But if you want to do empirical work, you're losing a whole lot of data points. So it's one of these trade-offs. Economic work, both theoretical and empirical, is hard. You have to make all kinds of compromises. And I'm just laying out some of those. So with all that, here is some a table of some data. These are 5-year sums, not averages, and you see that they've been growing to, in these years, something like close to 1.4 trillion per year, close to 7 trillion over 5 years. And of that, the share of foreign direct investment coming from developing countries, this is the one that we want to focus on, has been growing, particularly in the last 10 years. So the rate of growth of investment from developing countries is much higher than growth of world FDI as a whole. That coming out of China is growing faster still. And in fact, in the last 5 years, investment coming out of China itself, single country, is around 6.5% of the worldwide FDI. Now, in Britain, we hear kind of more about Tata and things like that. But that coming out of India is a much smaller part. It's still kind of barely 1% of the world FDI. That coming out of Hong Kong is quite big, but then I don't know how to really separate the China and the Hong Kong, what part of Hong Kong should be added to China, etc. That coming out of Russia has been growing quite fast. Again, I don't know, actually I don't know the data well enough to know whether buying British football clubs is a part of this, or what part of it is kind of escaping political risk of keeping your money in Russia, all kinds of problems in that. But the Russian one certainly is growing fast. And the Indian one, although small, is growing very fast. It was like nothing in 1990, effectively, and has been growing at a rate of around 36% a year. Of course, starting from a very small base, it's still not a very big part. And a picture is worth 1,000 words, maybe. So here is a picture of the same data. Here is the FDI as a fraction of the whole world's coming out developing countries. It's gone well past 25%, so it's really become quite a big part. And the trend that Lal and Wells spotted very early on has now become very big indeed. So we should give them all the more credit for seeing this coming way, way ahead of other people. So just to recap, a few quick observations. FDI from emerging countries, in fact, has been growing very fast in the last decade, and very significantly a China phenomenon. India and Russia are going fast, but still not that big. And it looks like FDI from emerging markets will become even more important in the future, so we need to understand the causes, etc., better. And specifically, we need to ask, is it becoming just like FDI from any other multinational, or does it still require separate analysis, separate explanation? And I'll argue a little bit of both. Special features are still important, and there's one new one that I'll say a little bit more about. But It will become more like any other FDI over the years if emerging economies particularly improve their governance to the point that they become pretty much integrated into the world economy in matters of governance. So let me begin with the kind of explanations that Lal and Wells found, just again a few of their key findings. They argued that bad governance at home made it more attractive to invest abroad. And that was particularly true in times of the license Raj in India, where investing in India was quite complicated. There are restrictions, there's bureaucracy, etc. So if you had profits and could take them and invest them in other countries, you would do that. That's kind of pull factor as well as push factors. Now, I don't know what's happened here, why that star or whatever it is, but sometimes Indian firms particularly investing in other countries, say in Africa or some of the Middle Eastern countries, were kind of invited there by governments in the host countries who preferred investment coming from a kind of fellow ex-colonial rather than from former colonial powers. Then sometimes emerging country firms used foreign direct investment to acquire technology, particularly by merger and acquisition. And that was more relevant for southern countries investing into the north. Some of it was to acquire natural resources or land rights, and some Chinese investments in Africa particularly were significant in that. And sometimes home governments, to get some of these advantages, technology, resources, land rights for food growing, etc., might encourage or subsidize FDI. Some new features have been noticed in some books. This book in particular is just about to be published. I've got detailed references to these at the end of the slides. And those of you who want to follow them up, maybe I can easily give you those. So they find that the emerging market multinationals now have bigger ambitions. They're not kind of marginal players anymore. They're not so constrained by foreign exchange. They're less constrained by home regulations. More interestingly, they're kind of more adaptable. They can change more quickly than some of the more ossified, rigid, if you like, northern firms can. And there's great heterogeneity. So not all firms from emerging markets have the kind of strengths that are mentioned here before. But of course, FDI comes from a selected subset, not from a random firm. And one new thing I want to emphasize is that having weak governance environment at home can actually be of help investing in other countries that also have weak environments. So the same book has a very nice quote that says, one of the core strengths of Indian firms is to extract maximum value from ailing businesses by applying innovative and cost-effective methods that they have developed at home over the years in extremely resource-constrained and uncertain environments. And the Economist magazine, in the usual way, had a beautiful way of expressing this. I suppose following Frank Sinatra, they said, if you can make money in India, you can make it anywhere. So what they have in terms of special skills is skill for coping with bad governance. Bad governance itself creates a kind of non-contractability, because you can't rely on judges to give good, fast, low-costly, etc. decisions. And if you invest directly and you know how to cope with situations of that kind at home, managing technology, building and using relationships, maybe based on ethnic networks, linguistic networks, etc., and being more willing and more able to bribe to get things done. These are advantages that southern multinationals can use. And they're asymmetric advantages. Firms from the north investing in south are more handicapped. It's easy to invest in a country that's got better governance than your own country. It's harder to do it the other way around. And some empirical work, in fact, I'll mention, has found this as an one of the reasons why southern multinationals have been successful where northern ones have not. So let me review a little bit of empirical work and connect it with a little bit of theory. Beata, in fact, was a co-author of one of the very early firm-level data-based empirical analysis that asks the kind of question that I'm looking at, but the other way around. And they were asking what difference it made for investment into a country that had higher levels of corruption. I'm going to ask in some ways what happens the other way around. What's the advantage of investing out of a country that's got high levels of corruption? But this one helps along. And they said that corruption in the host country does reduce foreign direct investment, but conditional on investing, it tilts it toward using joint ventures, presumably because the local partner knows how to cope with the situation at home. But then there's the problem that the local partner might steal your technology. So if the investment is in a sector that requires fairly high level of technology, then if you invest, you're kind of more inclined to do it in terms of sole ownership, vertical integration, as it's called, than get a partner. And can a multinational from a southern home country do better? So I tried theoretically to extend the analysis of Javorczyk and Wei by kind of adapting a diagram that they had. This shows different areas of the possibilities of governance quality in the host country and the level of technology of the investment. R is a kind of inverse measure of the quality of governance. Call it the level of rottenness, if you like. And T is the level of technology. So if you have high technology and a rotten country, you won't bother to invest. That's the region Z, where if you invest, it'll all get stolen. And doing it on your own, you won't be able to cope because of the bad governance. This region, where the technology is not so high, so there's less risk of being stolen, and rottenness at least is not too bad, you'll go for a joint venture. Whereas if the rottenness is low, then you can go on your own, because then you will avoid the partner stealing your technology. They were looking at this for investment coming from a northern country. And I want to ask, what difference will it make coming from a southern country? So a southern country multinational, we know from Lal Wells and everyone else earlier, that they are able to adapt their technology better. So their technology disadvantage is not so high. So it's as if you're moving down one of these green arrows. And you may invest as a southern multinational, when a northern multinational might have stayed out, you go in for a joint venture. You might go in a less rotten country for vertical integration, whereas again a northern multinational would have stayed out, or in this case you might go for a joint venture. And likewise, if you are able to cope with corruption, etc., rather better, then you might go, depending on the level of technology, for sole ownership, where the northern multinationals might have stayed out, etc. So a whole lot of possibilities theoretically are created and open up for empirical work. I've seen a little bit of empirical work. I'll just mention a couple of them. Demir and Hu, this paper actually does find exactly the kind of thing I was talking about in the diagram before. Institutional differences are a barrier to FDI, particularly from north to south, less for south to north, because it's easier to invest in a country with better institutions than your own. And multinationals from south have advantage investing in other southern countries, even ones with different institutions. Their kind of governance problems might not be exactly the same as yours, but at least you know in general terms how to cope with bad governance and can learn more quickly. But interestingly, they point out a kind of normative problem arising from this, which is it's been said that the need to attract investment will act as a spur for some countries with bad governance to improve their act. Now, if they are able to attract investment from other southern multinationals anyway, then this might get muted and their governance might stay bad for longer, which might not be so good. Another paper, actually, no, I'll skip this because it's not so directly relevant to what I want to say. And just say a little bit about the kind of cautions, worries that South to North FDI is causing. So for the home country, there's fear of capital flight. Southern countries are afraid that their firms won't invest at home, but will go somewhere else. Loss of control, you can't have tighter regulations, etc., if the firms can go elsewhere. For the host country, which is the northern country, the fear is that they'll lose their technology. They're the ones with the better technology. Southern firms will come and learn that and take it away. And also, in both directions, there's a general kind of xenophobic fear of foreigners, also of whether there'll be tax and regulatory competition that will lead to a kind of race to the bottom. Okay, so in the time available, of course, I've only been able to touch on a few things, but even that lets me say that it's been 33 years since Lal and Wells wrote their books. We can say that the multinationals from emerging markets have now come of age. Now, do you remember in which society individuals came of age at 33? You should know, in Oxford, hobbits. Remember, Frodo Baggins set out on his adventure right after his coming-of-age birthday party, the 33rd birthday party. So we can say that the multinationals have come of age, and they still retain some of the kind of characteristics of youth, but now they're beginning to acquire some adult characteristics. And the importance, both in absolute amounts and relative to world FDI, is growing. So we need, if anything, to step up the research that Lal began. So I'm happy to have been able to pay this little bit of tribute and give a little bit of overview, and we'll look forward to comments, etc. So thank you all.
Thank you very much, Afinash. We will have time for questions and answer later at the end. So now let's move on to our second speaker. Tim Besley is school professor of economics and political science at the London School of Economics. He is also visiting professor at the Institute for International Economic Studies at Stockholm University. Between 2006 and 2009, he served as an external member of the Monetary Policy Committee at the Bank of England. He's a fellow of the Econometric Society, the British Academy, and the European Economic Association. He is also a foreign honorary member of the American Economic Association and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He was educated at Oxford and was a Prize Fellow at All Souls College. Tim, it's a pleasure to have you here. The floor is yours.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks to Rani for inviting me. I nearly could come last year, but unfortunately my schedule wouldn't cooperate, so I'm delighted to have the opportunity this year. I actually went to Sanjay Alal's lectures when I was an undergraduate, and part of the way I got interested in development as a subject was through attending those lectures, so I'm immensely grateful to have had that opportunity. But I should say also that I'm delighted to be here with my good friend and mentor, Avinash Dixit. For all that Oxford tried to get me interested in economic development, Avinash tried to prevent that continuing. I remember very vividly a conversation I had with Avinash when I arrived at Princeton, where we were colleagues for a while, and he asked me what I was interested in. I rather gleefully said, "Oh, I'm interested in development," and Avinash replied, "Well, I used to be interested in development, then I discovered that all the problems of development were political, so I decided to give up that interest." Well, I rose to the challenge because I think these days we would say that the field of political economy and its role in development is rather a central area of concern. So Avinash, is, in most things, was ahead of his time in identifying that. I have many happy memories of the time I spent with Avinash at Princeton, but one of the most enjoyable days I spent with him was actually not in not at Princeton, but at the Oval, seeing an Australia-England test match. Avinash is a very keen follower of cricket, and when I lived in the States, he was one of the few people I could talk cricket with.
And it was especially enjoyable because England won.
Yeah, exactly. It was also enjoyable and unusual at that time. Anyway, so it's a great pleasure to be here. And today I'm going to focus on one particular mechanism on political economy in the context of the topic. I use this template, this colours template, and people try and interpret what it means. Last week I was presenting a paper with one of my Swedish co-authors, and people said it was in honour of the Swedish flag. Today I'll say it's in honour of the fact that there was a big celebration going on in St Giles at Oxford United, having just got promoted, and it's actually for those of you who know, the team colours of Oxford United. But that's not the reason I always use these colours, but anyway. Okay, what am I going to talk about? Well, I'm going to focus, to begin with, talk a little bit about where we've come in the political economy literature and then tie it to the theme of today's seminar. Avinash talked about the importance of governance and the role of rottenness in potentially affecting where foreign direct investment is located. And I'm going to amplify that theme a little bit, but I'm going to look at it through a very specific mechanism, looking and thinking about how political institutions affect risk, and that's typically policy and political risk, and how that influences foreign direct investment. And I'm going to do so through talking a little bit about some work that I've done in that area, and then try and tie it back to the theme that Avinash was talking about. Let me begin by just telling you a little bit about those of us who worry about the political economy development, how we approach that. And of course, people will talk a lot about how democratization has been a force in promoting or not promoting economic development. But I think a much more useful way, at least as a sort of first pass, and you'll see why I'm going to emphasize this in a moment, of when we think about what institutions matter, I think it's very important to realize that we often need to unbundle two quite different institutional arrangements, which are both part of what we think of as democratic institutions. One is the way people acquire the power to make policy, whether it be elections or military coups or whatever other method of acquisition of power might be relevant in different countries. And the other is what regulates that power once you have access to it. And that gets called various names, but I like to use the overall term of executive constraints. What constrains the use of power? And we know the answer to that, roughly speaking, in advanced democracies. It's parliamentary oversight. You have to have legislation passed typically through a parliament. The role of dictatorial legislation by chief executives is very limited, and the other is the role of courts. Now, what I'm going to suggest to you and show you indeed is that when it comes to thinking about the role of institutions in constraining policy, the role of executive constraints is far more important than the role of elections. This is actually, I think, a very important theme more generally in the political economy development, because many interventions to try and introduce democratic institutions, I think, have thought too readily that the answer lies in elections, when actually I would say for many countries, holding elections is not what they need. What they need is better constraints on executive authority. Now, why is that important? Well, we know a lot of facts about when we compare countries with and without strong executive constraints. One is, for example, civil wars are very uncommon in countries with strong executive constraints. And there's been an extensive literature in that area. And I think that's a very robust fact. What I want to talk about today is more of thinking about the role of those institutions as an insurance against policy risk. And I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing in a number of ways with a former student of mine, Hannes Müller. Now we know, and this is an important fact about the world, that volatility in general is much higher in emerging market and developing economies than it is in developed economies. If you look at different measures of volatility, you will find these are much more volatile environments. Now, part of that is just what you might call natural volatility. If you're specialized in agriculture, you're going to be much more susceptible, for example, to weather shocks or commodity price shocks. So there are certain kinds of shocks which are purely have an economic basis. But I'm more interested in the shocks that, in a sense, you could say are man-made, the shocks that come from policy responses to events. So how do you actually manage the risks that you are faced with? And we tend to observe that the kinds of political institutions we put in place in part play an important role in regulating the kinds of risks that governments have to manage. So let me show you a picture just to sort of illustrate this simple fact. This is a measure of growth volatility in two sets of countries in the world. Countries that have weak executive constraints, essentially you can read that, this comes from what's called the Polity4 database, for those who are familiar with that. Essentially it's a way of rating the political institutions of different countries according to the effectiveness of the court system and the extent of parliamentary oversight of policy. And what you see, if you look at the blue line, that's the high executive constraints countries, and the red line, one of the most striking facts is that quite a lot of the high performers are in the low executive constraints countries. Well, that's not surprising when you think China, you think of Korea as it was originally, Singapore. They're in the high low executive constraints countries, but also a lot of the poor performers. Think Zimbabwe or Democratic Republic of Congo, whichever is your preferred example. So what you tend to see is what you're buying in a way when you have weak constraints is a much more volatile environment, growth environment. And you can do this, you know, this is one particular way of looking at it, but if you look at the data in a very wide variety of ways, this fact is an incredibly robust fact, I'll claim, about what the world looks like. And you can look at it, it's also the same holds if you look at shocks to infant mortality, shocks to life expectancy. A whole variety of measures of shocks will look very similar. In other words, living in a world of weak executive constraints is living in a much riskier environment. And that's not just driven by economic shocks, because you can actually look at countries before and after. So you take the same country with the same economy and look what happens after it acquires strong executive constraints, you get the same basic fact. So it's a within-country fact as well as a between-country fact. Now this is interesting from the point of view of FDI. Because one thing you see when you interview CEOs and you even look at corporate reports of countries that invest abroad, risk management is a big part of the story. Indeed, there's a big risk insurance industry out there which exists to insure companies who want to invest abroad. And I'll show you, well, if I have time, I'll mention some data from a Belgian insurer that actually insures risk in multinationals and show you it's very strongly related to the kinds of political changes I'm talking about here. And we know from Avinash's very well-known work with Robert Pindyke, who, funnily enough, I had coffee with yesterday, who's in London at the moment. So Dixit and Pindyke's work on investment under uncertainty is really the most important work on that, and it's really about the effect of the fact that you will be deterred from investing because of the option value from a large amount of risk. Now, what are the risks that are associated with politics? Well, in extremis is expropriation risk. From time to time, multinationals will actually get expropriated by governments or by other private actors, and the government will not protect them. But actually, it runs much deeper than that. That's a kind of extreme case. Poor rule of law, weak contracting, the kind of governance issues that Avinash was referring to, and just generally poor macroeconomic policy. You're exposed to those risks big time. And as we saw, those risks appear, at least based on one diagram, but as I say, you can make the argument in a much more complete way. It looks as if that you're much more exposed to those risks in certain institutional environments, those where the executive face fewer constraints on what they can do. So I would argue this is an important issue, and it ought to be important in FDI, and I'll tie it back to the theme of the seminar in a moment. If you think about what we were doing this time last year, we were celebrating the anniversary of Magna Carta. Magna Carta is indeed the most fundamental constraint on the document that began the whole history of constraints on the executive. Britain, by the way, has a very unusual configuration of political history. We actually got the strongest constraints on political institutions before we introduced elections. For most countries, elections precede strong executive constraints, not vice versa. But because of our particular history, we got them in reverse order compared to most people. And that's one of the issues. Many countries run elections, but simply fail to constrain the people who win the elections. And that's why elections so regularly just lead to greater political instability than and the international community is yet to fully take that on board in the way it responds to political reform. Okay, now, let me tie this back to the thing, and I'll show you a couple of slides to give you something to take home. I'm going to show you it for a particular data set which has all the caveats associated with it that Avinash talked about. But it's a sector-level data set from the Netherlands National Bank, which essentially has all of the multinationals in the Netherlands and where they invested in the world. Okay? So it allows us to look at where did Dutch multinationals choose to place their investments over this quite long period. The nice thing about this long period is there was a lot of political reform going on in different parts of the world. So we can do a sort of before and after. Was there any evidence of a response of reforming our political institutions to the amount of FDI that at least Dutch multinationals were willing to place in your country? So here's an interesting story. This is just for the Dutch data, but actually if you did it for the global data, it would look really similar. This is the takeoff in FDI that Avinash showed us earlier. And basically it begins, the really big takeoff happens at around 1995. But look at the, what's the red line? If the world is taking off in 1995, what's the red line? The red line is FDI into countries with weak executive constraints. Basically, countries with weak executive constraints get no globalization dividend whatsoever. By the way, I like to think 1995 is a significant year in here because it's the first time I ever heard the word globalization. How do I know that? The person who actually uttered that word to me is in the room. It's Tony Venables over there. I remember talking to Tony when I joined the LSE in 1995, and he said he said something about globalization. I'd never even heard the word before. So, you know, it's like when you first time you saw the internet or whatever. Anyway, 1995, it turned out Tony was right. Look what happened after 1995. The world really took off in terms of FDI, at least. But it seems as if you join the club, so this is just the permanent differences between the strong and the weak executive constraints. If you join the club, you very quickly begin to get the same FDI as the other members of the club. In other words, if you reform your institutions, people seem to start investing in you. And let me show you this picture. This is a sort of an event study around year zero is the year you reform your political institutions to strong executive constraints. And basically what you see is you get an immediate dividend in FDI, And this is the before and after for all of the countries in the data who did the reform, and you get an immediate increase in FDI. And it turns out this is a fact. And you can look at this fact in a variety of ways, and you can do all the kind of things that economists are obliged to do to try and establish the robustness of a fact. But this is a very strong fact. Countries that reform their political institutions to strong executive constraints, who put real constraints on the power of government, tend to get a dividend in the form of foreign direct investment. And that's not just Dutch multinationals, that appears to be Baltic multinationals much more generally. The interesting set of countries, there are 34 countries in the data who switched, and you can really study their time pass in detail. And is this effect large? It's about 70%. If you are going to reform your political institutions to strong executive constraints, foreign direct investment goes up by around 70% as a consequence of that. So these are fairly chunky numbers. It doesn't seem to vary much by sector. We have it disaggregated. I won't really dwell on. Now, let me tie it back to a story that I wanted to tell you, which was the story that this has something to do with the management of risk. Okay? So what we did is we looked at the growth performance of these countries, and we did it before and after as well. So we didn't just look at the differences between countries, but countries after they reform. And we basically looked at the trend growth rate, how fast were they growing before and after, and what was the variance, how much variability was there in their growth before and after. And the bottom line story is you'll get almost no growth dividend by reforming your political institutions. The average growth rate in the economy does not go up or down significantly. But what you do get is a big uncertainty dividend. The before and after, you get a big collapse in the variance of growth in the data. And that's true whether you look at just the sample of countries that switched, which is obviously the more interesting sample because you're doing entirely off the before and after. Okay? So it does look like there's some evidence that what's going on here is that you're getting your political reform, you're reducing volatility in the economy. We would say that's by having a better policy-making environment, and that gives you an FDI dividend. Okay. It also turns out when we got the data from this Belgian insurer that insures multinationals, we find that the premium that the Belgian insurer charges, according to our measure of volatility within a country, sees a collapse in the premium. So if you're going to invest into a country with less volatility, your insurer is going to charge you a lot less for that investment as well. Okay, and as I say, it's correlated with investment flows. So what we did is we took the 34 countries that have made these reforms, and we're able to, for every country, tell you how much did their... So here are the countries listed from Albania to Turkey. Essentially, we're able to do a before and after for every country by looking at how its growth profile, either the volatility or the level of growth, changed. And the bottom line story is you get a very consistent pattern that volatility seems to be what's driving the result. Okay, so let me now come back to the theme and to tell you where I want to draw the lesson from this. Because what I've tried to argue is if you think about I would argue potentially an important one, 70% if you believe it is quite a big number, of the reason why flows are going around the world in the way they are is due to the nature of the political institutions and possibly tying that to a risk-based story. So you can think of one primary motive for a country to want to invest elsewhere if itself, and this is tied very much to Avinash's comments, one prime motive to invest out of a country is going to be to invest in an environment where the political institutions will give you much more predictability and a better policy making environment. I'm inspired to do, and sadly was not able to do for today, is to actually go and look and see whether, if we begin to get data on country-to-country investment, there's any evidence that this pattern is really driving the movement of investment flows across the developing world. At the end, one of the interesting speculations at the moment is on China. China, of course, does not wish to reform, at least under the current regime, its political institutions. It has low executive constraints. And China, in recent months, has had a period of extreme volatility. Of course, the question is that volatility likely to persist? Because if you take the story, the processes in government for managing the kinds of policy risks that underpin that are much, much more limited. I mean, we just have to watch this space and see, because so far China appears to have bucked the trend. I mean, it's had a very high growth rate, but a relatively stable growth rate. That's not true actually over a longish period. You go back to look at the period during the so-called Great Leap Forward, it certainly looks anything but stable. But if you take the period since the mid-1980s, it's a very both stable and high level of growth. Now, Avinash pointed out that a lot of Chinese multinationals are now pretty important, and we could speculate on that motive. But if China begins to be a country where the domestic stability becomes more and more of an issue, then the potential for Chinese multinational investment to become a source of escape from bad governance, to use Avinash's term, is something that we might see much more of in future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim. Now let me introduce the last but not the least panelist, Robert Waite of the London School of Economics. Robert was the first holder of the Sanjay Alal Visiting Professorship, so it's really wonderful to have him back here. His career spent both academia and international institutions. He started his career at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex, then moved to the World Bank, and then back into academia. His academic appointments included positions at Princeton Woodrow Wilson School, MIT Sloan School, Brown University, and of course, the London School of Economics. He was fellow of Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, of Russell Sage Foundation, and the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin. He has done fieldwork in numerous countries, including Pitcairn Islands, India, Korea, Taiwan, and several others. His book, Governing the Market, Economic Theory and the Role of Government in East Asia's Industrialization, won American Political Science Association's award of Best Book in Political Economy. Robert, the floor is yours. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much. So in a certain way, I'm an interloper here, the reason being that I actually know very little about this particular subject. And I think the reason that I'm here is because, one, I knew and liked very much Sanjaya, and two, because I was the first holder of this visiting professorship. But with those caveats, let me just pose a number of questions to both of the speakers. Avinash concluded his remarks by saying that research on the causes and effects of the differences between multinationals from the South and multinationals from the North should remain a high priority. And my question is why? That is to say, Avinash said very little about the significance of this growth of multinationals from developing countries, other than in terms of its size, its the rapidly increasing proportion of total global FDI coming from developing countries. But there are a whole lot of questions that then follow. For example, is there any evidence, is there any speculation on what benefits, development benefits, are accruing to home countries in the South from this rapidly rising FDI coming out of the South? What benefits are accruing? Can one expect that FDI from the South will continue to grow at anything like its recent past rate and will continue to yield large benefits to the home economy? And so one particular question that's very pertinent right now is what will be the effects on FDI from developing countries into the North of this rapidly rising opposition to the two big mega regional trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the and the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Opposition is rising to these on both sides of the Atlantic, and the question is this going to be something that will break the rise of FDI coming from the South? And also another question in terms of whether this growth is likely to continue. What happens when multinationals from the South attempt to take on Western multinationals in high-tech sectors rather than in low-tech sectors? What happens when they try to develop their own brand names in products that challenge existing Western brand names? They're almost bound to find it extremely difficult to get into northern markets where Western brand names are already well established, because it's very difficult to develop competing brands. So those are a number of questions. And another question that occurs to me is, are multinationals coming from the South, are they making use of the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism as a means of reducing risk, the kind of policy risk in particular that Tim was talking about? There's been a lot of hostility towards investor-state dispute mechanism, not just from NGOs and others in the North, but also from governments and firms in the South. The question is, are Southern multinationals beginning to make use of this mechanism, even though it is widely perceived to be a strongly Western-biased mechanism? So I have no idea what the answer to that question is, but it certainly would be an interesting question. I also have some questions for Tim. I would love you to elaborate a little bit on what is the content of this phrase that you kept using, strong or weak executive constraints. That is, you mentioned strong constraints come from strong parliament and strong courts over the executive, but it would be really helpful to me and for others, I'm sure, if you could spell out the content of this, how it is measured quantitatively. There's an empirical question about what's happening in the world right now. A number of political scientists have said that we are currently in a quite dramatic recession of democracy, a recession of democracy, pointing to cases such as Hungary and Turkey as recent examples, but there are many, many others. You divided democracy into two separate components, and you said one was much more important than the other. One was elections, one was strong constraints on the executive. And the question is, if you look at this trend towards a recession of democracy, quite contrary to what Fukuyama anticipated with his End of History, do you have a sense of what component of democracy is being eroded and the significance of that erosion in this trend that's called the recession of democracy? And then just finally, on China. China is a case with weak constraints on the executive. There is massive outwards investment going from China now, or certainly beginning to go from China, in these programs, the Silk Road programs, the One Belt, One Road programs. China is very aggressively and very centrally directed, creating infrastructure investments, infrastructure alliances, instead of military alliances. It's very weak on military alliances, but all across Eurasia, China is beginning to build these infrastructure projects, which are a substitute for military alliances. They are infrastructural alliances. And one particularly dramatic change that's going on is China is greatly reducing its investment in Africa, as in even in the space between 2013 and 2015, there's been a dramatic switch of investment from Africa to Asia as this One Belt, One Road mega project kicks out from China. And the interesting question then is how all this is going to be fitted into the larger dynamics that Avinash was talked about, and how it will fit into your argument about strong or weak executive constraints. So, yes, I should just explain. I'm going to finish at this point in the hope that Beata will take up some of my time, because she's the person who really knows a great deal about this subject, even though she's the chair and not the speaker.
Well, thank you very much, Robert. I'm actually not going to offer my own comment, but let me summarize the state of the discussion at this point. I think what we have more questions than answers at this point about emerging markets FDI. If you think about Avinash's presentation, he started out with the traditional view of FDI. That was the view of the northern FDI. Multinationals were perceived as creators of knowledge. In 2002, just 700 multinational corporations accounted for half of global R&D expenditure. And R&D budgets of companies such as Chrysler or Siemens were larger than what Russia spent on public R&D in that year. So they were creators of knowledge. They were perceived as a channel of knowledge transfer across international borders. Now let's think about Southern FDI. Is it transferring knowledge, or is it knowledge-seeking FDI? And perhaps Southern FDI can be viewed as a way of bringing knowledge back home and bringing benefits to the home countries, the benefits Robert asked about. Now, are Southern multinationals different? If we go back to the Caves-Dunning framework Avinash was talking about, ownership advantages were saying, if you want to do business abroad, you need to be better than your competitors because you are disadvantaged. You don't know the local rules, you don't know the local taste. You need to have ownership advantages. You need to be somehow better. So if you believe that framework, Southern multinationals should be actually sort of relatively close to the global frontier, right? In terms of at least management, in terms of some sort of intangible assets. But what if emerging markets FDI is subsidized, right? I mean, history repeats itself. Just like in the 80s, northern FDI was vilified in southern countries. It was perceived sort of as a, you know, neocolonialism, sort of some sort of imperialistic expansion. Now, in the Western world, we fear southern FDI, right? There's a lot of concern about Chinese investment in Africa. There is concern about Russian multinationals. Should we fear it? I don't know. But as Tim pointed out, some of those countries where Southern FDI originates actually lack executive constraints. But perhaps there is a more optimistic view. Perhaps these firms are looking to escape this lack of executive constraint and this great volatility at home, and they are looking to escape to countries with good governance. I don't know, but one thing is for sure. Emerging market multinationals pose new challenges for both academics and policymakers.
A lot of controversy and unhappiness. Now, I'm very mindful of the time. I hope you've had all an enjoyable evening. I believe we had a very stimulating discussion. Let's continue the discussion at the reception outside. Everybody's invited. But before you leave, please join me in thanking our distinguished speakers.